most important basis of the revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic was the participation of the people. This was not a revolution that was conducted by a, you know, officer corps of the military or the vanguard elite of some party, of some revolutionary party. It was a revolution that was conducted by the people themselves. And the whole establishment, the whole Islamic Republic is based on the participation of the people. I want to point out something, which is that, of course, the most important election today was the presidential election, but it wasn't only a presidential election. Here in Tehran, we had a very interesting ballot. We had three seats in the Assembly of Experts, which is the body that appoints the Supreme Leader. We had a one by-election in the Majlis, which is the legislative body of the country, and we had the local city council elections with 21 members. So, as you can see, the elections work on all levels, from the local level to the legislature to the executive branch, and even higher than that, that's related to the supreme leadership. And on all levels, the destiny of the country is determined by the vote of the people.
Professor Izadi, welcome to the program. Please give us your perspective on the significance of Iran's presidential election.
Well, the election is significant because it's going to have ramifications internally inside the country and internationally. Internationally, we have a number of Western governments headed by the United States that have always tried to demonize Iran and question the legitimacy of Iran's elections. You know, in political science, we have this democratic peace theory, which says that democracies don't have conflicts. And since the United States have been fighting Iranian people for many, many years, by definition, Iran cannot have a democracy, cannot be a democracy. And if you have millions of people participating in elections, then that needs to be delegitimized. And so the popular backing of the government should not be presented internationally. So the election process or results or the fact that people are coming to the polls needs to not be known to the outside world. And by doing that, they can say that Iran's government doesn't have legitimacy, and that way they can basically justify this economic warfare that they have been conducting against Iranian people. So that's why the election is important. If we have enough international media covering the elections the way they are and presenting the facts about Iran, that's going to make the job of people like Biden more difficult. And that's the basic aim. Internally, there are obviously differences between different candidates. So you had Dr. Hemati, who was saying that he is a technocrat. His domestic policy, economic policy, is very much inspired by the new liberal political and economic path internationally. And he was going to follow Rouhani's foreign policy as well. In fact, he was probably going to keep Dr. Zarif as the foreign minister if he gets elected. On the other hand, you had someone like Mr. Raisi that comes from this liberation theology background. He's a theologian, he's a cleric, and in line with what the Islamic Republic started with, helping the poor, these type of clerics, that follow the revolutionary or political Islam, say that we have a responsibility for the poor. So if you paid attention to the debates, you saw that he was talking a lot about the poor and helping the poor, and that's where he comes from. So he's not a technocrat. And he hopefully is going to learn from the experiences of the Rouhani administration for the last 8 years when it comes to foreign policy.
Mr. Tarabi, why are certain countries trying to undermine Iran's elections and its democratic efforts?
Sure. I mean, I think it's clear that when you look at the region and when you look at the way that the governments in the region are constellated, the reason that, for example, you have certain tribal rulers and family rulers in Saudi Arabia, Emirates, etc., existing is because of the support of the Americans. So what they fear the most is a Republican system of governments and a system of governance where the people get to decide who's the ruler. If you could, if you look at a place like Bahrain, the whole reason you had the revolution in Bahrain, which was violently and suppressed, was because there was a person who had been the prime minister for 41 years, who happened to be the, you know, uncle of the king, and the Americans and the Saudis insisted that actually the Saudis insisted that he remain as the prime minister, even though there were parliamentary elections in Bahrain that gave the majority to other parties, but the rulership was not willing to change that because the Americans and the Saudis were not happy about that. So the point is that the reason the enemies of Iran, whether it's the Americans or their local lackeys in the region, don't like the elections in Iran is because it shows their dictatorship. It shows to the world that they are dictators, and it shows to the world that they are racist apartheid states, like in Israel, because if you had an actual election in Israel where you included 48 Palestine, the West Bank, and Gaza, you would have a majority of Palestinians and non-Zionist Jews, if you include the ultra-Orthodox and some of the secular left-wing Jews that live in Israel, and you might not even have a Zionist state. So the biggest danger for America and the local rulers that are its lackeys is when the people get to vote. That's why they've been, doing propaganda against the Islamic Republic and elections in Iran for 42 years, because it shows their own weakness. And of course, the good thing about, the times that we live in is that maybe 40 years ago, with very limited media and very limited information that people had access to, you could have gotten away with lying about what the reality is. But we live in a world where information is transmitted very quickly, where people themselves can take the, films and the different information that they can gather and pass it to other people around the world. And it's very clear to everyone now that the only country in the region where there's any sort of meaningful participation of the people is Iran. One could include Turkey also in this, but there are issues with Turkey. If you look at the way, for example, Erdogan has turned it into a pretty much a personal presidential, we don't want to call it a dictatorship, but very, very authoritarian. And previous to that, of course, you had the army ruling in Turkey, whether it was in the background or openly, as they did after the coup in 1980. So the only country in the region where the people matter, where, as I mentioned previously, at every level of governance, beginning from the supreme leadership all the way down to the local level, it is the people who decide who runs the country and what policies are made for the future.
Professor Izadi, why are some Western countries adamant in trying to delegitimize Iran's elections?
Well, because they want to pressure the Iranian people, and by sort of questioning the legitimacy of Iran's election, they can follow and continue that policy. The fact that you have a significant portion of the population, we don't know how many people will show up on today's election, but generally Iran's elections attract more than 50% of the population. That has been, Iran has had 39 elections in the last 42 years, and with the exception of one, all of them attracted more than 50%. We have had cases in some years that the number of participants reached to 75-80% of the people who were eligible to vote. So if people realize internationally that majority of Iranians trust the system of government in Iran, that they go and stand in the polls for sometimes hours, cast the ballot, that shows that the government has legitimacy. And the fact that Iran's government has legitimacy gives it power in international arenas. And sanctioning this government is going to be more difficult. So what countries like the United States have to do is to question the legitimacy of the government and ignore the fact that there is this very significant popular support for the government. And interestingly, this is one of the things that people in Iran have realized. So when reporters talk to people who are standing in lines, a lot of times this issue of the fact that they're in lines because they want to send a message to the United States comes up. So what the U.S. is actually doing by interfering in Iran's domestic affairs, it's actually providing a reason for people to go to the polls. For people who may not have gone to the polls because of economic difficulties that they have and other issues. You know, this year there was this concern about voter participation because of two main reasons. One was COVID-19, you know, that crowded places, that when you go and cast a vote, there's a chance you may get sick. So that was one concern, that people would not go out. And the second concern was that the people who voted for President Rouhani 4 years ago and 8 years ago, and are not happy with his performance, and there are very few people in Iran that are happy with his performance, they may not want to vote for the other party, other camp. So they may decide to stay at home, because they don't want to vote for Rouhani, they don't want to vote for Rouhani's line, they don't want to vote, for example, for Mr. Hammati, and they don't want to vote for the other side. And the reason they don't want to vote for Mr. Hammati is because they're not happy with the way Rouhani conducted his government. And so there was this concern that people may not come to the polls as much as they did before because of these two reasons. So and we have to wait and see basically how many people will show up.
So Matthew Torov, you mentioned the issue of voter turnout and the people's presence. Those are comments that were also echoed by Ayatollah Khamenei. Also, many observers, they maintain that a strong voter turnout, it displays national unity against the enemies. The Iranian president, the incumbent president, said that a strong turnout will frustrate the adversaries of the Islamic Republic and it can foil plots of Iran's enemies. Unpack that for us.
Sure. I mean, I think most of the issue was discussed by Dr. Izadi, and I don't know if there's any much more I can add to that. The reality is that Iranians need no foreign or outside reason to go to the polls, because we have a 100-year history of people being martyred, executed, tortured for us to have the vote. It started almost more than 100 years ago with the Constitutional Revolution, which then ended up in the Pahlavi dictatorship as installed by the English. Then in the 50s, we had the Mossadegh nationalist government, again overthrown in a coup by the Americans. And then finally, in the late 70s, we had the establishment of the Islamic Republic, which for the first time allowed the Iranian people to have a vote. So for us, having the vote came with a very, very high price. Our grandfathers, our fathers, our great-grandfathers, our grandfathers, our fathers, and mothers and great-grandmothers and grandmothers were, suffered a lot for this. So yes, of course, as we look at our own history, we understand those who actually know their history know why they have to go vote, whether it's to, live up to that legacy as it relates to the British at the beginning of the 20th century, or as it relates to the interferences by the Americans in the late 20th century. And these things didn't change after the revolution. They didn't change. The Americans and their allies, the Europeans, and their local lackeys did not suddenly decide, oh, yes, okay, we accept the fact that the Iranians have decided that they want to have a republic and not have an absolute monarchy for 2,500 years. We accept the fact that the Iranians don't want to live in a semi-feudal country with 30% literacy, which is what it was in the year that I was born, 1972, there was 30% literacy and 70% illiteracy in this country. Anybody who has a brain, anybody whose, rational thinking capabilities are not, in some way distorted, can tell the difference between the Iran that we have today and the Iran that existed 42 years ago when the revolution happened. So yes, of course, those countries whose goal and stated goal for over 100 years is to control West Asia, which is the most important strategic area of the world. West Asia, according to the Westerners, this is not my claim, this is their own analysis that they have been telling the world for over 100 years. The most important strategic area of the world is West Asia. And guess what? The heart of West Asia is Iran. So whoever rules Iran, again, not my analysis, this is what they're saying, whoever rules Iran and West Asia rules the world, because that person, that country or that alliance is able to control the flow of everything from east to west, is capable of shutting down oil and any sort of strategic, you know, whether it's in the air or whether it's in the sea, any sort of strategic and military, you know, going back and forth between north and south, east and west. And so, of course, they are very hurt by the fact that they lost Iran. They had hoped with the Pahlavi regime to have their local, you know, bully here, which they call the local gendarme, to be able to go and kill whoever they want in the region, but not, you know, get their own hands dirty. Something that, for example, the Saudis or the Israelis are now doing more and have taken over. And very recently, unfortunately, the Emiratis, as we see in Yemen. And so when they lost that, they lost, you know, the crown jewel of their West Asian empire or their global empire. And they can't handle it. They can't get over it. Whether the Iranians want to have Dr. Rouhani or Dr. Ahmadinejad or Dr. Khatami or whoever as the president, they don't care. The important thing to them is whoever comes into power is put under pressure, and that somehow in their deranged analysis, they think this is like the Soviet Union or East Europe at the end of the Cold War, where somehow if people are, you know, driven to starvation, they will rise up. First of all, we're not driven to starvation. During the worst sanctions in human history, again, as claimed by themselves, we've had the most significant technological advances. We don't have widespread hunger. We don't have desperation. The only thing we have is we have those countries not wanting to accept that Iran takes its position as the natural hegemon of West Asia, that Iran takes its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization. As we saw, as the leader pointed out in his speech, in the middle of all the sanctions and all the maximum pressure, we are one of the few countries that has developed not only one, but four or five, I don't even know now, four or five vaccines against COVID, which, you know, sure, inshallah, will be passing out. So again, it's about Iran not being powerful and Iran not taking its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization, and they can't handle it. And that's why they do what they do for all these years.
Professor Izzati, I'd like to get your thoughts on what Mr. Torabi just mentioned. You know, the United States at the helm of the Western world, they claim to be advocates of democracy, but looking at their track record in the region, putting the magnifying glass on the region, I know it transcends West Asia, but just focusing on the Middle East, they don't want democracy in the region. As Mr. Torabi pointed out, the 1953 coup in Iran shows that as well. Can you explain that double standards that we're seeing from the United States?
Well, they actually have to explain what they are doing, because they very much like the Shah regime, they like the monarchies in the southern states in the Persian Gulf, and they don't like Iran, that has one of the thriving democracies in this region and internationally. So the double standards need to be explained by the other side. The fact that there is a republic now after many centuries of the monarchy system is something that people cherish. So with all the difficulties that people have in Iran, they like the fact that they get a chance to vote. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about this fact that all these monarchies around the Persian Gulf don't do any elections at all. And they are financing television channels based in London that are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls. And they are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls because they claim that Iran's government is not democratic enough. So what Ayatollah Khamenei was saying is that the countries that are paying for these channels don't know the difference between the ballot box and a fruit box. because they don't do elections. For these countries to want to undermine Iran's democracy is going to be something very foolish. And for governments like the United States to be supporting these countries and then fighting Iran, that's also very foolish. It hasn't worked. The U.S. policy towards Iran in a major failure in the last 42 years. And with people's participation, Iran will maintain its standing and will ensure that the U.S. policies will continue to fail. And the sooner American officials realize the facts about Iran, the sooner they realize that the people of Iran are not going to accept a government like Shah's government. They're not going to do that. They're not going to allow their government to be run by the United States. The sooner they realize that, the better it's going to be for them, because the failed policies of the past has also hurt them at the same time that they have hurt the public in Iran.
And Salman Titorabi, very briefly, if you may, Mr. Izzati just brought up an interesting point there about the United States criticizing other countries' elections. The Electoral College, that's a mess. The recent presidential elections in the United States, it was chaotic. I don't have the proper words to say what it was. It was a bunch of political shenanigans being played out. The United States is not really in a position to criticize anybody's elections, is it?
Absolutely not. Anybody who's lived in the States like we have knows that, especially in those areas that are controlled by Democrats, we have almost 100 and sometimes longer 100-year history of the mafia and the local mob working with the Democratic Party to vote for whoever they want to do. I don't have the facts to show you that there was fraud, but I am positive that there was fraud in many of those states like Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin or New York or New Jersey or Florida. So these are things that anybody who's lived in America knows. The fact that you don't have the empire media, the boot-licking media of America, you know, talking about these things, well, you know, maybe that's the problem. It's not that the American people don't know. And if you the polls have been conducted, up to 70% of Republican voters, in some polls it's 50%, do not consider Biden to be a legitimately elected president. You know, I don't want to talk about that maybe that much because, hey, whatever. If the Americans, you know, think that that's a problem, it's their responsibility to have a revolution like we had a revolution.
Okay,
so, inshallah, they will have a revolution.
All right, I'm sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, political analyst and university professor Fouad Izzati, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also thanks to director of Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute, Mr. Salman Titorabi, also speaking to us from the Iranian capital. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's debate. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah,
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
إن هي إلا حياتنا الدنيا نموت ونحيا وما نحن بمبعوثين.
Life is not but our worldly life. We die and live, but we will not be resurrected.
إن هو إلا رجل ترى على الله كذبا وما نحن له بمؤمنين.
He is not but a man who has invented a lie about Allah, and we will not believe him.
So, as you have been previously with us, in the previous programs, we started talking about the third section of the chapter, where the Almighty Allah in this chapter talks about the generations that were raised after Noah's people. The generation under discussion was probably Thamud, based on the commentaries and the traditions, and their leader, or better say their prophet, was Prophet Salih. Anyway, the chiefs from among the people denied him and said that he is nothing but a mortal like you people. He eats from what you eat, he drinks from what you drink, and if you obey a mortal like him, this means that you are completely losers, because he is promising you that when you are dead and you have become dust and bones, you will be raised again. Now, in the 37th verse, the Holy Quran states, إِنْ هِيَ إِلَّا حَيَاتُنَا الدُّنْيَا نَمُوتُ وَنَحْيَا وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمَبْعُوثِينَ. There is nothing but our life in this world. We die and we live, and we shall not be raised again. So, continuing to talk about the possibility of returning back to life after complete annihilation in the earth, the disbelievers said, إِنْ هِيَ إِلَّا حَيَاتُنَا الدُّنْيَا. There is nothing but our life in this world. Some of the unbelievers believed in Allah, but they did not accept the resurrection and prophecy. And this is the first thing that we can understand from this part of the verse. They rejected the saints and friends of Allah, as well as the divine promises, with the claim of preserving the sanctity of the Lord. And this is their other reason to deny the resurrection. So, إِنْ هِيَ إِلَّا حَيَاتُنَا الدُّنِيَا. There is nothing but our life in this world. They actually implied that when there is nothing left of them after death, there is going to be one appearing after another. One generation always dies, and another generation takes its place. And the verse continues saying, نَمُوتُ وَنَحْيَا. We die and we live. So, one generation after the other. وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمَبْعُوثِينَ. We shall not be raised again. There is nothing like a resurrection. So the self-conceited people are so big-headed and ignorant. They have so many inflated ideas in their minds that they cannot see possibly anything or anyone else. So that's why they say, there is nothing but our life in this world.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فَبَدَا وَضِيئًا كَالنُّجُومِ تَأَلُّقًا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
That is why they say, أَيَعِدُكُمْ أَنَّكُمْ إِذَا مِتْتُمْ وَكُنْتُمْ تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَنَّكُمْ مُخْرَجُونَ. In the 35th verse, as you were with us, they said, does he promise you that when you are dead and have become dust and bones, you will indeed be raised from the dead? And they say that that thing is far from reality, hayhat. And literally, the ones who are looking only at this world, and the ones who are having only the kind of materialistic glasses on, they only can look at what is before their eyes. They can only see their own paths and no one else's. That's why they were so degraded from their real stance and positions as human beings that in that situation, when they were trying to deny the prophethood of the Prophet Salih, they introduced themselves while they were polytheists and maybe disbelievers. They introduced themselves as the one who are actually preserving the sanctity of the Lord. While exactly it was vice versa, the real support for the religion of Allah and the one who was preserving the sanctity of the Almighty was the Prophet, was Prophet Salih, but he was introduced in the eyes of the society as liar, as the one who is claiming that those people will be resurrected and will be raised from the dead again. And this, in the eyes of the people, was shown as total lie. Now, they will also continue talking about their argument in the next verse, and it somehow becomes personal, and they attack the Prophet's character. So stay with us while we will talk about in the next program regarding the 38th verse. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
reporters.
Just a quick one. When are you going to?
He might have emerged the loser in a bitter internal power struggle inside Downing Street, but Dominic Cummings is reminding his former allies inside the Conservative Party that a wounded animal is at its most dangerous. Prime Minister Johnson is standing by his health secretary, even after Cummings leaked messages where Johnson branded the man in charge of handling Britain's COVID crisis as expletive hopeless and suggested handing over some of his responsibilities.
Dominic Cummings is doing this because he's his own axe to grind following his sacking as Johnson's political aide. It's clear I don't think we could trust him as far as you could throw him, but at the same time he's shedding light on what seems to be a chaotic and inefficient government whose handling of the beginnings of this pandemic was truly disastrous in terms of the number of people dying, the highest in Europe.
In an escalation of tensions between Cummings and Hancock, MPs were told back in May that the health secretary had lied to the prime minister about testing hospital patients before they were released into care homes at the start of the pandemic. In a 7,000-word blog, Cummings described Johnson and co. of rewriting history and said if number 10 is prepared to lie so deeply and widely about such vital issues of life and death last year, it cannot now be trusted either on COVID or any other crucial issue of war and peace.
Hell hath no fury like a special advisor scorned, and Dominic Cummings is making life inside the Conservative Party for his former colleagues an absolute nightmare. After all, he's the man with an agenda and the inside information to follow through.
Cummings's refusal to slink off into the political wilderness must be a source of great concern for the government, who must be dreading what he will reveal next.
I don't think he's particularly bothered about the damage he might inflict on the Conservative Party, or indeed his former boss Boris Johnson. Clearly his anger over his sacking has overcome any reservations he's got.
This might be unfolding like a poorly written telenovela. But the public will do well to be reminded that these individuals at the center of this political drama, they were the ones in charge, making decisions that may well have cost thousands of people their lives. Amina Taylor, London.
For ages, joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been a long-sought dream for Ukraine. NATO countries have a mutual defense pact, meaning if one nation is attacked, the others will join in their response. By this, Kiev, which has been engaged in a domestic conflict with pro-Russian forces, is seeking to get NATO's help to get rid of the militias. On Monday, the alliance's annual summit in Brussels wrapped up with the release of a joint communique that reaffirmed NATO's 2008 decision for Ukraine to become a member through a Membership Action Plan, or MAP, without setting a timetable. Shortly afterward, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appeared to announce a change on Twitter shortly before U.S. President Joe Biden began a news conference in Brussels where he was attending a NATO summit. He tweeted that NATO leaders confirmed that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. But NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made it clear that no such action was imminent. Stoltenberg said, "To agree on the membership action plan, you need a consensus among 30 allies. This was the focus of the summit." Biden stressed that Kiev does not have the go-ahead to join NATO. The U.S. president said Ukraine needs to clean up corruption and to meet other criteria before it gets into the action plan. However, he affirmed Washington's support for Ukraine's territorial integrity. Biden also met with its Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin for the first time in Geneva, Switzerland on Wednesday. The two discussed a number of issues, including resumption of diplomatic ties and the return of expelled envoys, but apparently made no mention of Ukraine's membership in NATO. On Thursday, the Kremlin expressed concern over talks for Ukraine to join the alliance. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Ukraine's NATO membership would be a red line for Moscow, noting that Russia is watching the issue closely. Ukraine has been locked in a tense tug-of-war with pro-Russian forces ever since the Crimean Peninsula rejoined Russia following the ouster of Ukraine's president Viktor Yanukovych in 2014. The conflict on the country's east has killed more than 4,000 people.
The General Confederation of Lebanese Workers, the country's labor force umbrella, called for a nationwide strike across the country. Several streets in major cities and a number of key highways were blocked. Banks, several large companies, and many shops also remained closed. Head of the General Labor Union stressed in the gathering that all institutions of Lebanon are threatened, as are the citizens of the country.
We need to face this collapse of institutions through social solidarity and cooperation to preserve what is left of Lebanon and the workers of the country. This cannot happen without a salvation government which confirms political stability, paving the way for economic solutions.
The crisis has deeply stressed the budget for subsidies on essential goods. Power cuts have increased in many areas, which are seeing only 2 hours of electricity per day. People are lining up at gas stations for up to 2 hours to get limited liters of petrol in their cars, while supermarkets and pharmacies are running short of supplies. The General Labor Union in Lebanon has declared that all members, including economic bodies, Organization of Merchants, and even the Association of Banks in Lebanon, back the strike and allow their employees and workers to take part in gatherings and protests. And while this strike is to protest the main dire economic situation in the country, it is also to put pressure on the political factions to form a much-needed cabinet. Parliament Speaker Nabi Hibiri has declared an initiative to help mediate stalled talks to form a government. The disagreement is mostly prominent between Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri and President Michel Aoun, who don't see eye to eye on the general framework of a cabinet lineup. Members of the parliament close to the speaker believe this initiative is the last resort.
This initiative is the last opportunity for the Lebanese to see some agreement on a cabinet. All political factions inside Lebanon backed this proposal, and it was also endorsed by regional and international sides, since it provides a plan for a comprehensive solution. Speaker Barry has put forth a practical framework and tactical steps to try to loosen the knot on debated issues, but this requires mutual trust and reaching a common denominator where the collapse will continue and we will all regret it then.
The World Bank has labeled Lebanon's economic crisis as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. Lack of accountability has also been one of the major reasons behind an extended, multifaceted crisis in Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Jerusalem is closer than ever is the slogan for symposium held in Yemeni capital Sana'a to discuss the Israel's long-lasting atrocities against the Palestinian nation. The organizers say the recent 11-day war has proved that the third generation of Palestinians is more capable of standing against Israel. They say the resistance has got stronger despite the normalization efforts of some Arab states.
The axis of resistance was able to prove its existence despite all the conspiracies of the closest people. There are Arab countries that are considered close to the Palestinian resistance, but unfortunately, they continue to stab the resistance through normalization with the Zionist entity. And these countries are the ones who seek to weaken and bring down the resistance. Today, the third generation of the Palestinians is capable more than ever of defending Palestine against Israel's aggression.
The gathering also hailed the support of allies for Palestinian cause, including Iran, who they say has always backed the Palestinian nation overtly. The participants said Iran has played a key role in changing the balance of the war between Palestine and the Israeli regime.
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran 40 years ago, it has made Palestine its main issue, as Imam Khomeini declared that Iran's independence will not be complete without the liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is at the heart of Iran's political strategy, and despite the conspiracies that Iran has gone through, it still supports the Palestinian resistance and has been a key factor in changing the equation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The Palestinian cause is also an issue of consideration for several other Islamic states, including Yemen. Last month, Yemenis launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance groups, even though they are going through a tragic humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
People here believe that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They say the recent victory proved that the Palestinian nation is on the right path to regain its rights. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Pro
push back, constrain, and engage. These are the core elements contained in a European Commission policy proposal which has just been presented relating to Russia. The 27-country bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the EU must be realistic.
And prepare for a further downturn of our relations with Russia, which are right now at the lowest level. And this further downturn is the most likely outlook for the time being.
The new policy proposal suggests the EU must push back against Russia's human rights violations and international law breaches. This mostly relates to Ukraine and Georgia. The EU must constrain attempts by Moscow to undermine EU interests. Here the document talks about cyber attacks. But the bloc should engage with Russia on COVID-19, climate change, travel visas, and efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. Big claims require big evidence, and the EU has never come forward with a shred of evidence, the Kremlin insists. There are many experts who believe the EU is going down the wrong path.
The West has an interest, an institutional self-interest, in aggravating the crisis with Russia, a crisis which need never have started in the first place, but which was aggravated by the way the West supported the most radical elements in Ukraine.
Borrell was asked about the EU's dependency on Russia's energy. He responded, there is no mention of this subject at all in the policy document. The Commission proposal contains a provision for additional sanctions on Russia, but EU leaders are divided over the effectiveness of such measures. They will make their final decisions on the matter during a summit here at the European Council next week. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After two perilous days and a difficult night, 69-year-old activist Nicholas Georges has returned to ground level after mounting a huge crane overlooking the US Embassy in London. Armed with little more than a Palestinian flag, Georges risked his life in the daredevil stunt to raise awareness of Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
Every day, day in, day out, demolishing more and more Palestinian homes. The Palestinians have no rights. Even their electricity and their water is taken from them. Israel is the fourth largest military power, nuclear military power in the world. The Palestinians have nothing.
Apart from the obvious risk of falling to his death, the two-day ordeal has been very challenging in other ways too, as explained by fellow activists supporting him from the ground.
Apart from the climb itself, which was huge, he has suffered from the cold at night because he couldn't fit a sleeping bag onto his backpack. So he spent last night very cold, and he sent a few messages saying, I'm really, really cold. Luckily, because he's so high up, the crane actually caught the first morning sun. So he was the first person to actually warm up. But now he's suffering from the heat because obviously there's no shade.
As supporters cheered Mr. George's successful landing, he was unable to speak directly to us, as any media talks after this action could affect his possible court battle to come.
So there you have it. Nick is back down safe and sound. But the battle will not end here. After a visit to hospital, Nick will likely be brought in for questioning by the police and potentially even charged for some of the conduct over the past couple of days. Then could come a lengthy court battle, which Nick will have to fight against as well. But the lessons that can be taken from this is that the activists behind these brave actions know the consequences, but they still do it anyway, meaning that until there is a solution for the oppressed Palestinian people, this type of action will continue to occur, not just in the UK, but worldwide, possibly as well. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up Al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem Al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Marib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Marib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Marib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Marib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is the proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al-Bayda and Marib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new low in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh. This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul. In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least 7 Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for western Kabul or approve people's security plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warned of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.